Lesson 4. A day spent in silence.
The bells returned to the manifested realm. Refreshed. The ringing of the bells traditionally is a spiritual wake-up call. Preceded usually by the alarm clock. That's another kind of waking up. As we are speaking of waking up, I hope the people in Austin and Hollyhock are fully awake also. They are over there where the camera is. I'm sorry you have to get up so early. But you're here. This is the day that we spend in silence. Except for this person up here. Well, not really. Although the words are there, there's still the dimension of silence, of stillness, is present. More important than the words. So if you can be attentive to both the words and, more importantly, that which is between the words, which to the mind is nothing. And indeed it is no thing. And yet it's an energy field. The wonderful thing is, you cannot become attentive to that without the same field of stillness being activated within you. The very fact that you notice the silent gaps in between words or in between sentences means the very same silence, the very same stillness at that moment is in you also. Otherwise, you wouldn't even notice it. And you may also be surprised to find that in the moment of noticing the silent gap, you are not thinking. You may also find, if the gaps become too long, you notice it at first, and then you start thinking again. That's okay. Or you may not. But that is the most significant thing that can happen to you in this lifetime, on this planet, where you've taken temporary form as a so-called person. Of course, you are consciousness. The most significant thing is this cessation of thinking without loss of consciousness. From our normal perspective, the perspective of the normal everyday mind, the perspective of thought, it looks like there's nothing there. There's nothing there that can be grasped or understood. And yet it's the ground of all being, the very ground of your existence. Existence is the manifested. Being, the way I use these words, is the unmanifested life that you are. Underneath the form, the background, we can also call it. So, to be aware here, continuously, of the background to all this, the field of stillness, the field of aware presence, of self-aware stillness. And also be aware of that which arises in the stillness. Words, sense perceptions, bodily sensations. But to have your roots, to be grounded in the stillness, and here, all you have to do is be aware of the gaps between the words. Now, there's something that cannot be manufactured, something that needs already to be there in you, a readiness, the ability even to be aware of the gaps. We could call that ability alertness. And that's the true meaning of waking up out of the dream of thought, of being identified with a continuous stream of thought. So, most of you, or almost everyone here, has this ability already. There's enough presence in you so that you can notice, be aware of the silent spaces. And in that awareness, the awareness of the silent space, really, what is a silent space? It's the absence of something. Where before there was a word, the word has returned, the sound has returned into nothingness. Before there was something, now there is nothing. So this, what is the silent space? It's the absence of something, of the thingness of life. So when we say you are aware of the silent space, it's a strange way of putting it. It works as a pointer. But what does that really mean? You are aware, first you are aware of a word. Your attention is on the word. Then the word disappears. And it is not replaced by inner words arising in you, because attention remains. The word disappears. And so when we say you are now aware of the gap, what's really happening is you have become self-aware. Awareness or consciousness has recognized itself. Without it, the object is gone, just the field of bare attention remains. And that is a realm of also of great peace, the silent peace that's always there in the background. And as you realize that, it seems to become stronger. It seems to grow inside you. That's probably a perspective only, but it seems to grow and become stronger. So as you sit here, you don't grow in knowledge very much, except a few Zen stories or something. But you grow in awareness. However, any words that we use to describe it are already somewhat misleading. Perhaps a better way of putting it is to say that as you sit here, you shrink. The person shrinks. The personal sense of self that's identified with thought diminishes and something else emerges. And so I've pointed out before, maybe not here, this is not a personal development group. Sometimes I say that when I arrive at the airport and the immigration officer says, "What are you going to do here? What do you teach?" In order to reach him at all, I sometimes say personal development and know that it's not true. But if I said personal shrinkage, he wouldn't let me in. Now the person remains, but what gradually happens is there comes a shift. The transcendent dimension in you becomes stronger than the personal. The personal can still be used. Your name, the conventions that are to do with the way of interacting with others. But more and more something else flows into that. And we could call that stillness, but not stillness as just an absence of noise, but stillness as an alive presence. So stillness flows into your sense perceptions. It flows into your looking. That's why if you've been looking at things in nature and realize that it becomes so much more alive when you don't label or interpret it. So it flows into your looking. So the stillness is also attention. It's a stream, one could call it a current of awareness. Where before there was thought, very different energy frequency thought. When you approach anything or perceive anything through thought, very different frequency. You can see when you look at a person, whether he or she is perceiving you through thought or through stillness. Or when a person is looking at something, you can see whether they are classifying it, interpreting it, finding some kind of personal relationship to it. People do that with trees and flowers too. Some people have the compulsion to pick flowers. because they need to enter into a personal relationship with the flower, not realizing that they could be in a much deeper relationship if they went beyond the personal that says, I would like to have that. Or even if you don't pick it, you might think, how would that look in my garden, in my backyard? Or have some kind of comparison to it. Put it in some kind of comparative category. It's not even necessarily to do with yourself, but it's still I overheard a man saying he was looking at the sun, at the sky after sunset, or was it after sunrise? Just that. And he said to his companion, look at that Turner sky. Turner is a British artist who lived, I believe, in the 19th century, who painted beautiful paintings of light, sky, and just light. And finally, he was looking, but it also had to be compared to something. You can look more deeply if you don't classify and compare it to anything. And it is likely that Turner himself looked at the sky in the state of complete open presence, with reference to nothing else, not to another word, to a word, or anything else. And sometimes you find people who are walking in nature and it's beautiful and lush, but the mind comes in and for a moment they look and then they say to you, yeah, oh, you should go to Hawaii, it's even more lush there. And then they start telling you about Hawaii while you carry on walking. So this current of awareness flowing through you into your sense perceptions, your seeing, your hearing. But it also flows as a kind of emanation, because every human being has a certain emanation. Now, most humans have the emanation of mind. And many humans, in addition, have the emanation frequently of pain body. And many humans have a very nervous emanation, tense. Where's the next thing? They want to get to the next thing and at the same time feel threatened by the next thing that's going to come. So that's what they emanate with their whole being. And that's the entire civilization. To a large extent, big cities have that energy field that's generated by millions of people. There are certain other countries where at first it feels, there's less nervousness here. But then you realize they're actually, the energy field, although it may not be nervous, is a little sleepy. Instead of going beyond thought, they are drifting below thought. And so you tend to see lots of people sitting or lying around street corners in a state of semi-sleep. And yes, it feels, if you come just arrived from New York, it feels great for a while. And you also sometimes find human beings who seem to be more peaceful. And you yourself may find that in certain situations or conditions, you're not as nervous after a few drinks, after taking this or that substance. And it's great, it can is a glimpse of what it means not to be thinking, that how alive you can feel. But in many of these cases, when you've taken a few drinks, yes, you're beginning to step out of thought and you feel better. Oh, that feels good, I must have another drink. Oh, let's have another. And before you know it, you're going towards unconsciousness and sleep. Yes, you have stepped out of the stream of thinking, but have stepped, one could say, in evolutionary terms, you're stepping back.
Lesson 4, continued on Disc 5.
You have stepped out of the stream of thinking, but have stepped, one could say, in evolutionary terms, you're stepping back. That too can be a relief. But this is not what's happening here. We, from the stream of thinking, we are stepping beyond. We do not go back to sleep when the mind no longer thinks. We are more alert, far more awake than when we were immersed in thinking. So there comes that quality, that's the way we are going. Yes, we are transcending thought, not back to where we came from, but rising above thought. Now that state of rising above thought, where you can still use thought beautifully, powerfully, when it's needed, but you are no longer possessed by thought or consumed by thought. Thought, useless thinking, burning up a lot of your life energy. Not going anywhere, just going around, just like the car is in neutral, you're pushing down the accelerator, not going anywhere, just vroom, 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 for hours and hours and hours. So stepping beyond thought into that clarity and alertness. That is both gentle and fierce. That has two aspects seemingly contradictory. It's very gentle, that energy field of alert presence, but also has a fierceness. It needs to have a fierceness because it needs to cut through thought. That substance, that, and thought is heavy, dense. So to cut through that density of thought, coupled with the density of the emotional field that goes with the thoughts, you have the two layers, the density of thought, the density of that emotional field, pain body, and they cling together as two layers of density. And then comes presence, and in this case here it comes from two directions. That's why it's possible for this to happen. From within you, that dimension of presence emerges, pushes forward. But it might not have enough, in the absence of extreme and agonizing suffering, that cracks it open from above, from it may not have enough power to cut through the density. So all you feel then is an extreme restlessness, something wanting to happen, and there may be searching, and oh, something wants to be almost be born here, but it can't be born. It's not because the shell is not cracking. But here it's being also pierced from here, from this, the energy field that is here in this room that comes through this teaching, which is more than the words. So that the presence is cutting through from within you and from without. So it's just the way they built the Channel Tunnel from two ways. They started in England and in France digging. And finally they met in the middle. And they had cut through these layers of seemingly impenetrable rock. So if it were not already happening from within you, it would be meaningless and it wouldn't work for you to be here. So the layer of thought that that stream is being cut through, and when you leave here, there will, we trust, be enough presence in you so that it can happen without the external help, although occasionally it's still helpful to listen, to be reminded, to open a book and read just a few lines that have come out of presence. That's helpful, as long as you need it. But there is enough presence in you now so that you can use it as a sword. And I'm now talking about the active side of presence, because presence is both fierce and gentle. It has an active aspect and a passive aspect. It depends from what perspective you look on it. So when we say that allow this moment to be, in that there is an arising. This surrender and presence go together. Surrender to what is one side of presence, and that looks passive. But that is not the full picture. You cannot surrender to what is, it would not work, if there were not also a fierce aspect to presence, an active, very active aspect to presence. So on the one hand, it's very gentle and allowing, but it is also, it acts like a sword that cuts through accumulations, collective, of the collective human mind and pain body. So there comes this attention. When the Zen master raises his finger and looks at you, there's a fierce look on his face. We see it in old drawings of Zen masters. You wouldn't want to meet them in a dark street. The eyes come bulging out of their heads. So they represent the fierce aspect of presence. Underneath it, if you look closely, if the artist who draw this drawing of the Zen master was in tune with the Zen master's inner state, if you look closely, you will find also hidden there underneath the fierceness, the gentle aspect of presence. It's hidden. If you look into the eyes, they both are present there. So, allowing what is to be needs to come together with a sword-like aspect. Almost what seems, the mind would say, irreconcilable but they're not irreconcilable, perhaps only from the point of view of the mind. So, how does that work? This moment, something arises. This moment takes form as an event that appears in front of you, a person or an event. Now, allowing this moment to be as it is in whatever form it arises, requires you to face fully what is, not opposing, facing in an open way, not facing in a as if you were fighting a battle against something. You face it in an open way, like this, to have your arms extended like this. You face, so this is the gentle, and yet at the same time you look it straight in the eye, so to speak, whatever it is. This is the gentle, the receptive. And the attention is the fierce. So you welcome what is, but there's a fierce attention that flows through you onto whatever it is that's happening. Not fighting anything, just its fierce alertness. And that cuts through the old reactions that otherwise would, that are all accumulations in the reactive mind. They can then not operate anymore. And intelligence itself, which is attention is great intelligence, but very different from the accumulated so-called intelligence of the human mind, that is a limited aspect of the greater intelligence, a limited form that this greater intelligence can take, which is fine too. It's only not fine anymore if that is all you know and all you think you are. If you are good at solving IQ tests, well, that is an aspect of the limited intelligence, and that's fine if you're good at that. If you get your identity from that, it becomes problematic. I'm a member of, I think it's in England, they have Mensa, which is all the people who have very high IQs can become members of that. And some people let that flow into a conversation just casually. Now, if I'm offending one or two people here, I'm sorry. That is beautiful. Why not? If you can use your mind in such a way, it's a beautiful thing to do. If that becomes an important part of your sense of self, then you get trapped in an illusory identity, and you probably have a few more things to add to it. And that is part of identifying with the realm of content. I don't qualify to become a member of Mensa, unfortunately. The mind doesn't work in that way anymore. I think it never did. I could never solve mathematical problems, and I always admired people who could. I can't even see where the problem is. Thank you. when I was at school. After the age of 13, I stopped going to school. I couldn't stand it anymore. But I still had, they had all these problems that you had to solve. I couldn't even, my mind would go blank after reading the first few lines. A man has 5 sacks of potatoes and then he takes 2 away and takes half of that content out and puts it into another sack. How much is left? And that's okay for a problem to solve if there actually is a man. So we are conditioned to create problems for ourselves. That lies in the conditioning of the mind. And so often, when you think you have a problem, really, your mind is creating a problem for yourself. If it isn't happening at this moment, if there's no action you can take right now, and so comes the fierce aspect of presence. Oh, I've got so much on my mind. So much, what is the expression? So much on my plate. God. And so you need to remember the sort of presence. What's the problem at this moment? Can't find any. Yeah, but it's not this moment, but tomorrow when I get there, what's going to happen when this or that, when the moment comes? There's more than enough power in you to face it and to take right action when right action is called for, because you will face the challenge when it's true in that state of welcoming attention and look it straight in the face. And in that moment, there is no thought. When you face a challenge truly, there is no thought, there is just the looking. And it may be an actual looking or metaphorically speaking, you're looking at the situation, the totality of what has arisen at this moment, what needs to be solved, responded to, dealt with at this moment. And you look. And in that looking, that is fierce and gentle at the same time, there is an activation of a greater intelligence than what you have learned, whatever you may have learned. Now, what you have learned may eventually come into play also, because eventually, perhaps, you will take action, part of which is to do with certain things that you have learned to do. Or you will speak words, which is to do with using language that you learned in the past. But that will be only an instrument of the, it will be inspired use of whatever form comes into play when you deal with it. But there's always, there's the moment of alert, aware sessions in which there's no thought and there's just the looking. And any master does that in any field, has the ability to look for a moment and then respond out of that. The greater intelligence responds out of that. You just... In the same way that great sportsmen play their sports, no tennis player, great tennis player thinks, well, I think the ball is going to come there next, so I'll better move to the left now. Now I've got to get ready for the other side to jump to there. Now I have to 2 meters forward quickly. It would be impossible through conceptual thinking in the mind. There is no thought. And if thought interferes, they're not playing well today. And they all have days when they're not playing well. And very great sportsmen actually enjoy tremendously the flow of energy and realize that they are not doing it. But there's the ability to just be there. So this is the non-conceptual intelligence in you, the non-conditioned, unconditioned intelligence in you that becomes activated. And that deals with problems beautifully, true problems, or rather true challenges, because there are no problems. Problem arises when you are either imagining something happening to you now, it is not happening, you're somewhere else, it's not happening now. You're dwelling mentally on some possible situation. Because even if you had an illness that is very problematic, you don't know the outcome. Will I survive or will I not survive? Of course, eventually, nobody here survives as the form. How much longer will I survive? Is that... Now, to some people, that becomes a dreadful burden to know that you have a condition that you may not survive, which, of course, everybody is suffering from it in a wider sense. It's an incurable disease called mortality.